My name is Troy Williams. I'm one of more than 2 million men serving time in America's prisons. I've spent nearly half my life inside this prison system. The thing about prisoners is, most of us get out. In fact, two of the men whose stories you're hearing today are already successfully back in society. That's why we produced this series, to give you a window into what's usually considered a secret world.
I was very self-centered. It was all about me type of mentality. My childhood was so rough, so therefore the world owes me everything, and I'm going to get it any way I see fit.
I've always wondered what forgiveness would look like.
Me being a criminal and always having a criminal mentality about how to make money, financial education took that out of me because criminality no longer made sense anymore. It was like, now that I'm seeing it from a financial perspective, I'm now weighing my options about what's worth it. It economically don't make sense no more to break the law.
Today, you're going to hear stories from California's oldest prison, San Quentin, where I've been serving time for nearly 2 decades. These pieces are produced by inmates working on the San Quentin Prison Report with help from KALW Public Radio in San Francisco. Our first story is about a young man who grew up homeless. By the time he was 17, Curtis Carroll was in prison, convicted of murder. He learned to read there, and literacy transformed Curtis Carroll, who, as Tommy Ross reports, is now aptly named Wall Street.
Curtis Carroll is 34 years old, but he looks about 25. He's clean cut, wearing dark shades and a gray baseball cap turned backwards. It's hard to imagine that he was homeless as a kid.
My mother was a drug addict for many, many years, and we moved from place to place a lot. She used crack cocaine for a long time since I was a kid. So we got evicted, you know, out of our various homes that we lived in, and you know, we lived in missions and, you know, Christian homes and churches and things like that for a while. I mean, basically we was homeless.
And this affected his school life. He was kicked out of schools in both Oakland and Richmond. Perhaps he didn't learn to read because he would pay other students to do his homework and test for him. In 1996, at age 17, he was arrested for murder.
I remember I went to court, and my lawyer was telling me about the case, and he had gave me a bunch of papers to read. And he pretty much was explaining everything to me, and I was kind of just like nodding my head like, yeah, I understand, but I really didn't. I thought, well, the tricks and things that I've used through the years to get people to do what I want them to do didn't work in this particular environment.
He was sentenced to 54 years of life and eventually ended up here at San Quentin. One day, while seeking out the sports page so that the cellmate could read it to him, he stumbled across the business section of the paper.
And I was like, what's that? He said, that's that paper in your hand. And I said, stocks? Well, what do you mean? And he said, yeah, you know, this is a place where you can go Wall Street. You know, you can go and you can invest in stocks and you can make money. And I'm like, really? Can I do that from here? He said, yeah, you can do it from anywhere. And that's what sparked it. And that was the, so okay, let me, you know, see a little bit more about how this process works.
That spark lit a fire for young Curtis. He was assigned a tutor that provided him with Star Wars books to read. But it was the financial information that motivated him to learn.
I guess I was probably about 19. And when I started to learn how to read, financial publications was what I was reading. You know, I was reading the business sections of the newspaper. And so, though I was still educating myself and trying to get my reading skills up, because I was reading about finance, it was kind of opening my eyes to what the world had to offer, you know, from a different perspective from the way I've always seen it.
And people started seeing him differently, too. In fact, he's become such a financial wizard that now everyone calls him Wall Street.
The name Wall Street was given to me by a brother that I met some years ago who was in one of the classes that I was teaching. Kind of defined the new me. They say that our names are usually a tag of who we are and what we've done in the past. And so this new me and what I'm into with finances, I think Wall Street kind of fit perfectly with that, with the reinvented.
The name of this course is called FEEL, and it's an acronym that stands for Financial Empowerment Emotional Literacy.
Wall Street became such an expert in finance that prisoners began asking him to teach them. And now he teaches a class about personal finance and stock investing under the Financial Literacy Division of SQPR.
In prison, you can buy stocks three ways. You can buy stocks what they call direct investment purchase, which is considered a drip program that allows you to write the company directly. Then you have the other process, which is called going through an online discount brokerage. Then you have the way where you have your folks in the streets have you go through an actual brokerage where the broker does the work for you.
The curriculum he teaches is based on what he calls the four timeless rules to personal finance.
Saving, cost control, borrowing prudently, and diversification.
He provides a practical example for prisoners.
So saving would be, you know, a person in here who is not spending all his money at the canteen. You know, cost control would be a person who says that, you know, I have $100 and I'm only going to go spend 50 this month and I'm going to save 50. Borrowing prudently means that you know you have the money before you borrow it versus what someone else is going to give you. And diversification is allowing your money to do multiple functions. So instead of you, for example, if you was working in PIA.
PIA stands for Prison Industry Authority. It's a place where some prisoners work various jobs like making furniture, upholstery, mattress, and bedding, while earning wages from a scale of 30 to 95 cents with an average of about 75 cents an hour.
And you was making money and getting a check, and then you was a drawer. And you draw cards and you sold cards on the side, that's diversification. Because not only are you getting a paycheck from PIA, you're also getting a check, you're also making money off the cards that you're doing from the drawings.
Today, Wall Street has a new perspective on criminality, thanks to its newfound knowledge about how the financial system works.
For me, being a criminal and always having a criminal mentality about how to make money, financial education took that out of me. Because criminality no longer made sense anymore. It was like, now that I'm seeing it from a financial perspective, I'm now weighing my options about what's worth it. It economically don't make sense no more to break the law.
That's quite a revelation for someone who once considered himself a criminal. Wall Street says he has a new outlook on life, but it's not about greed.
I don't worship money. I don't worship money, and I don't love money. But what money does for me is it's a necessity to allow me to do the things that I've been striving to do in life, as far as change, helping others, and things like that.
He insists that financial education is basically understanding how to manage money properly and how to make it work in a person's life.
We never really lose where we come from. We just learn to morph into something else. But if you're out there and don't have a way to produce, you tend to go back to what you know. And to get rid of that totally, like I have, you educate yourself on finances and you never have to worry about that again. And so that's just what I really want to get out there to the people.
Word up, Wall Street. Keep hope alive. This is Tommy Shakur Ross with the San Quentin Prison Report. I'm out.
You're listening to a special from KALW News. I'm Troy Williams reporting from San Quentin Prison in California, where these stories were produced by inmates in the prison. Let's go back 30 years now, to 1984. Miami Vice and The Cosby Show were top hits on American TV. And Run DMC, Houdini, and Curtis Blow dominated the hip-hop scene and airwaves. That was the year Marcus Williams, no relation to me, went to prison. He was 17 years old. Now, nearly three decades later, Marcus is about to get out on parole. He's matured and learned a lot since he got to prison. But even after all this time, he says there are a few things he's still working on.
Being able to trust people. That is something I had been struggling with for quite some time. And I took that from my childhood out there in here. And to be honest with you, I'm still struggling with that right now today.
Even so, Marcus ultimately credits the men he met inside San Quentin with helping him believe in himself and in the possibility of getting out. SQPR's Saad Wallace Stepter brings us his story.
Well, Marcus reflects on who he was as a young man. He's quick to point out what it was about him that got him in trouble.
I was very self-centered. It was all about me, type of mentality. My childhood was so rough, so therefore the world owes me everything, and I'm going to get it any way I see fit.
Even if that meant using violence.
I never went anywhere without a gun because I knew that in some form or fashion, people were going to test me in certain ways that was going to be detrimental to my health. So it was like it was that whole F the world type of mentality, man.
This mentality would lead Marcus to get involved with gangs. And at the age of 16, he was arrested for first-degree murder. And by the age of 17, sentenced to life in prison. Unfortunately for Marcus, his introduction into the prison system began with a lesson that would almost kill him.
Within the first year, I had an attempt on my life. Within the first 6 months, I almost got put into a wheelchair.
Marcus says he was the victim of a brutal attack by rival gang members while he was lifting weights with other inmates.
Me and one dude, so-called homeboy, we doing what is called 21. You take a light boy, you do 7 reps, you give him the boy after 7 reps, he gives them back to you. So after about the second time, after I hand them back to him, next thing I know, I just get pummeled with 80-pound dumbbells, man. And I see dudes all over me, but the dude in front of me take off running, and he's over there on the ground with his jacket over his head. If I wanted to run, I couldn't. There was nothing I could do. I tried to defend myself on my back, but there was nothing I could do. I got a weight bench thrown on me after that.
After the attack, Marcus was sent to administrative segregation, also known as the hole. After a year in the hole, he was transferred to another prison.
When I got to Folsom, Folsom was already on lockdown. There was already a war between two races, so we spent about 8 months on lockdown.
That means inmates are confined to their cells for 23 hours a day, and all inmate movement is restricted unless under direct escort by guards. This gave Marcus a lot of alone time, and he says something started shifting in him.
I just had a lot of time to think, so I started becoming somewhat of a loner, you know what I'm saying? So the majority of my time, my first 2 years, it was just focused on me handling my own, and like I was saying, it was all about self-preservation. So the best way that I can survive is just start subtracting these dudes regardless of how long I've known them. Just start staying away from them. I pick and choose who I want to talk to, but after a certain amount of time, I got to let you go your way, I got to go mine.
This was a turning point for Marcus, but influences from the outside world would ultimately have the biggest impact on him.
One thing that frustrates us being in prison, anybody, is that you don't have control over certain situations that takes place outside of these walls.
Family tragedies forced Marcus to reflect. His cousin was murdered, and within 2 weeks, a dear aunt passed away. For the first time, he would think about what type of future he would have when he got out of prison.
The one thing that I'm really starting to fear is that if I get out of here, everybody that I love is going to be gone.
At this point, Marcus's main priority became working on himself in order to become a better person, so he could be there for his family. He started participating in self-help groups, and he says he committed himself to personal growth and change. He was transferred from Folsom to San Quentin, and at San Quentin, Marcus noticed something at this prison that he found to be very important, something he had never experienced anywhere else.
There's a community support within the guys in Blow, and you're not going to find that in too many other places. I can't speak for any other place, but here you have a profound network of guys that support you through and through, and I've never seen that in all my years in this institution.
That support, along with all the programs offered at San Quentin, programs like No More Tears, Alliance for Change, and the Prison University Project, helped Marcus to learn from his past mistakes. During his nearly 3 decades in prison, Marcus had been before the parole board and denied on 4 separate occasions. But in 2012, he had another chance to convince the board, and this time they saw something in Marcus that was different.
Well, I changed my thinking process. They didn't see that gang member. They didn't see that person that had caused all this trouble out there in the community, especially at the junior highs, which is where my crime took place. they didn't see a gang member sitting before them coming in there with all these issues, with this frown upon his face. They seen somebody who was still somewhat troubled, but at the same time did everything he could and within his power to change his life the best he could.
Now, after 29 years, Marcus is set to be released from prison. And a lot has changed since Marcus was last out.
As opposed to when I left, society, in my opinion, seems to be moving a lot faster. Society seems to be somewhat possessed by their possessions, meaning that it's materialistic driven to a certain point.
To cope with this, Marcus has a simple plan.
Patience, 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 and I'm saying it because nothing is going to get handed to me on a silver platter. I got my work cut out for me. And the one thing that I've learned is that if I didn't want to go to school, if I didn't want to work in here, if I didn't want to do anything, the one thing that I was going to learn is patience. And that's what it's going to take, and it's going to take diligence. And it's going to take me being focused and I have to not allow myself to get sidetracked by some things that I know that are going to come my way. Because it's going to be rough at first. I know that. So it's going to take a whole lot of self-discipline as well. So,
to the man that Marcus is leaving behind in San Quentin, he leaves this final message.
Stay strong. Be strong. Stay self-disciplined. Keep your head up, man. And live your life to the fullest, man. And do not give up, man. Do not give up. I love y'all, man.
Reporting from San Quentin State Prison, I'm Shot Wallace Stepter for SQPR.
Marcus Williams has been out on parole now for a few months. He's living in transitional housing on the Oakland-Berkeley border. He volunteers as a peer counselor and has a job at a local theater company. He recently reflected on what it means to be out of prison.
You know, when you're in prison, you know, prison is not made to motivate you. It's made to discourage you. So therefore, they treat you a certain way where, you know, they try to dehumanize you in every shape and form, and they don't treat you like you're a human. They treat you like a number. And I think the most important thing to me is that people treat me like a human being. And that is one of the most amazing things that I've experienced since I've been out.
A single crime can take place in a matter of seconds, but its effects can last a lifetime. That's true for the victim, but also for family members, friends, and neighbors. The formal justice system doesn't usually address these aspects of crime, but the restorative justice approach can help victims and offenders heal. In this next story, we'll hear about the transformative effect victim-offender dialogue has had on a man currently serving time in San Quentin. From within the prison walls, Tommy Shakur Ross reports.
Greetings, everyone. Recently, a prisoner named Kairi met with the sister of a man he murdered 23 years ago.
So when you sit across from someone that you've harmed, you're going to hear from them personally what that effect was and how that affected their lives. Initially, she and I broke out and we just cried.
Kairi also learned some things about the murder victim of his crime that he hadn't known prior to talking with her.
He was 42 years old at the time. I didn't know that. I didn't know that he flew airplanes. I didn't know that. I didn't know that his father had died like a year, like a week and a half before I murdered him.
Victim-offender dialogue is based on the principles of restorative justice, which emphasizes accountability, empathy, and amends. It places the people impacted by crime at its center. In this instance, she wanted to know why he killed her brother. She wanted answers.
She wanted to know, who was I before I murdered her brother, what my life was like. She asked me what happened on the day that I murdered her brother. And she went on for the third question, was that, who am I today?
Kairi told the victim that he was an addict
and spent 10 years chasing drugs, that he had built up a lot of anger, despair, and rage because he had become an addict. He also told her more about the gruesome details of the murder, but out of respect to the victim, we won't discuss that here. At the end, Kyrie began to tell her where he is in his life today.
The programs and everything that I've been involved in since I've been here at San Quentin has given me an opportunity to really take a look at my life.
Kyrie is a certified drug counselor and has been a participant and facilitator in a number of self-help and rehabilitative groups that focus on addiction recovery counseling and restorative justice themes.
In order for restorative justice to actually work, the offender and the victim needs to be a part of the process so that some understanding on both sides could really come to some full understanding of what this feels like, what this looks like, and what we can do to bridge that gap or to repair the injuries.
The amends process can start by asking how, if possible, can the victim be made whole again. Shortly after their meeting, Kyrie wrote the victim a thank you letter to thank her for having the courage to come and meet with him. And she wrote him back, expressing her feelings and what it felt like for her.
Dear Kyrie, although it has been 5 months since I met with you, I have thought often since then of our encounter. When I received your letter of thanks, I was very moved by your honesty and by learning that our meeting has helped you in your healing process. I determined at that time that I also wanted to write a letter of thanks to you, but I needed more time to understand my feelings. I will tell you that our meeting was one of the most profound encounters of my life. Why? Because both of us were speaking from a very vulnerable place in ourselves, a place at the essence of whom we each are. Most daily encounters are not that way.
Kyrie shares how he felt after reading her letter for the first time.
I broke down in tears because when I wrote my letter of thank you for her being a part of this dialogue, I wasn't really sure in my mind how she had felt. So knowing that I was able to give her what she needed from me, that really, really made a big difference.
Apparently, the dialogue profoundly impacted both Kyrie and the victim in a powerful way. It set them on a path towards healing, honor, and validation.
I've always wondered what forgiveness would look like. I know that in that process, it's a hard thing. It was a hard thing to ask for forgiveness because I was living with so much shame, you know, so much anger towards myself. In her response, she said, "Kyrie, I forgive you."
Some victims who choose forgiveness could experience a deep sense of healing, but some victims may not want to ever be bothered or heard from by an offender. Just remember, if people can harm, people can heal. If people can harm, people can also help and serve. At its core, one can see the interrelationship between all of our actions and their effects, good, bad, or indifferent. I'm Tommy Shakur Ross with the San Quentin Prison Report. I'm out.
We just heard how restorative justice changed Kyrie's life. But can the victims of a violent crime benefit from that process as well? For Deion Wilson, it wasn't until 7 years after her husband, a San Leandro police officer, was killed in the line of duty.
For many years, I carried around so much vengeance and hate. And I realized at a certain point, I had nothing left. I had no more tools. I engaged in a lot of self-destructive behavior. I I tried to buy my way out of my grief. I tried to drink my way out for a short period. Thankfully, I didn't take that too far. And I just didn't have a way to move past being embroiled in that moment.
At first, Dionne thought the trial and conviction of her husband's murderer would bring her some sort of comfort or closure.
I kept thinking, it's almost over. He's going to get convicted. He's going to be on death row. I'm going to feel better. I'm going to feel better. And then when it happened and he did get put on death row, I waited and I waited and I waited and I went, huh, wow, it really didn't work. And so I realized that the only way out of it was a different route. I didn't know exactly what that was, but that's kind of a long story.
And it took a long time. Eventually, Dionne decided to try restorative justice. She got counseling to prepare her to meet a murderer, someone like the man who killed her husband. In Dionne's case, she couldn't actually confront the true offender because he's on death row and appealing his conviction. So Dionne met with what's called a surrogate, and she says that helped her to begin her healing process. After meeting a surrogate face-to-face, talking about redemption, justice, and the searing pain of loss, Wilson finally felt ready to send the letter to the man who killed her husband.
Knowing that he heard my words, that was really enough to give me so much healing. It was amazing the effect that it had on me and my life. What I'd really want to say to him is to not give up on the life that he has right now, because I know that, you know, when you're sitting in a cage and you know you're going to die there, there's no question you're going to die there, one way or another, that it's really easy to lose hope and think that there's no possible way you can have a positive effect on the world. But I don't believe that. I believe that he can.
You've been listening to a special from the San Quentin Prison Report and KALW News in San Francisco. This show was edited by Holly Kernan, Martina Castro, and Casey Miner, with research help from Ray Sue Sussman. Our engineers are Seth Samuel and Chris Hoff. Nigel Poor is the SQPR producer. The SQPR production team includes Tommy Shakur Ross, Greg Eskridge, Sha Wallace Stepter, Curtis Wall Street Curl, Brian Acey, Erlon Woods, and Louis A. Scott. Special thanks to Shireen Garcia and June Hamamoto for transcribing our pieces. And to San Quentin Public Information Officer Sam Robinson, Television Specialist Larry Snyder, and Warden Kevin Chappelle for supporting this project. I'm Troy Williams, and I'll be back tomorrow with more stories from the San Quentin Prison Report.